From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. During decades of Jim Crow, African American travelers couldn't be sure what they'd face at a strange restaurant, a hotel, even a gas station. Would the door be slammed in their face, or worse? The Green Book, an annual listing of establishments welcoming black customers, started in the late 30s. We speak with Ann Bruder, a State Highway Administration historian who is researching Green Book businesses in Maryland. With Tracy Wright of the Park School, who discusses the Green Book with students from several high schools on an annual civil rights trip. And with civil rights icon Dr. Helena Hicks, who recalls using the guide when she traveled for her work.
So the Green Books, while they helped get me going in the right direction, I could not always rely on them for comfort and safety.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Merry Christmas. Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. The movie Green Book, set in the 1960s, evokes the Jim Crow era South, when traveling the open road could turn unpleasant, even harrowing, for African American travelers. Where would a black customer be welcomed to eat a meal, fill a gas tank, spend the night? Often, the answers came from the Traveler's Green Book, which was published from 1936 to 1966. The cover of the 1940 edition, headlined The Negro Motorist Green Book, carried a price of 25 cents and offered listings of, quote, hotels, taverns, garages, nightclubs, restaurants, service stations, automotive, tourist homes, roadhouses, barbershops, and beauty salons, close quote. Where were these establishments? Many people today don't know there was a Green Book, let alone what it listed. In the summer of 2017, we talked to a teacher who was sharing the news with young people and to a civil rights activist who remembers the Green Book and its limitations. First, we met a historian who is part of the movement to capture the history of the Green Book before it disappears. Ann Bruder is a senior architectural historian at the Maryland State Highway Administration. She has identified scores of Green Book establishments in the Free State. When we spoke in August 2017, she told me she learned about the Green Book when she read The Warmth of Other Suns, Isabel Wilkerson's book about the great migration of African Americans from the South.
One of the people that was interviewed, a doctor from Louisiana, drove from Louisiana to California. And when he got to New Mexico, even though he had a copy of the Green Book with him, he decided not to stop. And he thought he'd be able to get accommodation further west, and no one would let him stop. So he was forced to drive all the way. I think he actually had to go all the way to California.
So that caught your attention.
It did.
What did you do from there?
The Cultural Resources section at the State Highway Administration has a library, and somebody mentioned to me that there was a copy of the Green Book, one of the Green Books in the library. So I checked it out and looked at the Maryland listings, and I wondered if any of those were still in existence. And about a year ago, my friend Catherine Ziff wrote a newspaper article about a Green Book beauty salon that was in Providence, Rhode Island.
Catherine Ziff is based in, she's an architectural historian,
yes,
as you are.
Yes.
And she's based in Rhode Island.
Yes. And she told several friends about the article, and our comments were all the same, like, we'd like to know more about Green Book sites in our states. And so she said, well, why don't we try to do posters, and we'll display them at a couple of upcoming historic preservation conferences. And we've displayed them at three or four different conferences, and they've been well received.
By other historians.
By other historians.
It's probably not fair to ask you to summarize a poster. I've seen electronic version of your poster, and it's got scores. How many precisely of establishments? Lots.
Lots.
All over the state. And photographs and maps. But you tell me what people should know about this poster you've created.
That the buildings still exist, although we're losing the history. One of the buildings in Frederick, for example, was a boarding house from the late 1920s until the late 1940s. And today it's a barber shop. And I stopped in to, I was taking a picture, and the man who owns the building saw me taking the picture. And so I walked in to introduce myself and explain what I was doing. And I said, this used to be a boarding house. And he said, it's never been one. My uncle bought it in the 1960s. Well, the history goes back to the 1920s, 1930s, and he didn't live there and just wasn't aware. So part of my interest is spreading the word that what you know is your history, there may be more to it.
In Baltimore, I mean, many of us know that Pennsylvania Avenue was a mecca for Black entertainers from all over the country. But Black entertainers, famous as they may have been, still had to make sure they had a place to stay. Tell us about when Pearl Bailey visited Baltimore.
She first came, or at least one of the first instances that I can find in doing my research through the Afro-American archives, is that she came in 1942, and the paper noted that she stayed at the York Hotel, which was actually on Madison Avenue, and it's been demolished and is just a plain grass lot at the moment. But she sang at the Adams Club in down in Turner Station. And that was a little unusual, but it was during the war, and she was trying to make a big circuit and entertain as many people as possible. And, you know, because the populations were shifting, she wasn't necessarily staying or singing on Pennsylvania Avenue. She might have had to go a little further out, but, you know, they were very pleased to have her.
You found some confusion in some of the Green Book listings.
Yes. One of the listings is for a guest house on, which is listed as Bloom Street. And in
B-L-O-O-M.
Well, that's the way it sounds, but it was actually spelled B-L-U-M.
The street was
in the Green Book. And, you know, there have been many changes in Baltimore over the years, and I first thought that perhaps the street had been just removed. And instead, in talking to Catherine one day, she told me that she had discovered that some of her listings were misspelled or people had misunderstood somebody's name. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe it isn't B-L-U-M, but it's Bloom, and I should be looking for B-L-O-O-M. And in doing that, I was using the Baltimore City telephone directory, which lists telephone numbers according to address. So I was able to go to Bloom Street and discovered Miss Etta Watson living on Bloom Street in an apartment building. And it's right around the corner from the YWCA. And the YW kept a list of names of people who had spare rooms who would be happy to put somebody up if the Y couldn't accommodate.
That's Ann Bruder, an architectural historian with the Maryland State Highway Administration, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Green Book, the guide that helped African Americans travel safely during the era of segregation. You note that the physical buildings of many of the Green Book establishments have been demolished. You note that on your poster, your listing of different ones. And one of those is the Harmon Hotel in Hagerstown, correct?
Yes.
Tell us the story there.
The Harmon Hotel has a rather long history. It was built probably in the 19th century from the picture, the one image that we can find. But in 1915, it opened as a hotel. And so it's a rather early hotel for African Americans in Western Maryland, which is where Hagerstown is. And the Harmon family ran it as both a hotel and an apartment building. In the 1940s, for example, the principal of the North Street School in Hagerstown, which was the African American school, resided at the Harmon Hotel. And then in 1950, Willie Mays came to play baseball as a member of the Trenton Giants. It was his first major league game, or his first professional game.
He wasn't able to stay at the hotel where the white players stayed.
No, because segregation was still the law of the land. And so several of his teammates came to stay the night with him because they objected to the notion that he couldn't stay at the White Hotel.
You told me that, tracing the history, some people may be surprised by the location of some of the Green Book establishments you found.
I think so. For example, the YWCA was originally the synagogue house for a local synagogue before they moved to Northwest Baltimore. And the neighborhood in Frederick, I think, was a white neighborhood before African Americans started moving in. And I see it as layers of history that we need to remember, that just because you think of a neighborhood as being Jewish or African American or white or German or, you know, any variety, it does have those many layers.
The Green Book was published by Victor Green and his wife Alma. He was a mailman in New York City.
In Brooklyn.
And how did he come to do this book, do you know, and to do it for 30 years?
There was a real need for identifying places that were safe for African Americans, and it was something that had been going on for a while. The first directory for African Americans traveling was actually published in 1930. It was the Hackley Harrison Directory of Apartments and Hotels, and it listed 300 different sites in the United States. And then it was only published that one time, and then they didn't publish it again. I suspect that the financial situation in the early 1930s with the Great Depression probably played into that. And so it sort of went fallow, and then Victor Green picked up the mantle, if you will, and he published the first directory is just New York City listings and perhaps some suburbs in New Jersey, but basically it's New York City. But the need was so great that he spread the word. And in 1939, his introduction to the Green Book mentions the Jewish travel directories that were published in the 1920s. And they obviously influenced what he was providing in terms of, you know, businesses. And not every hotel in Maryland that would have been available to African Americans is included. And I think that being included was a voluntary thing. And for instance, the Henry Hotel out in Ocean City was only open to African Americans in September after the main beach season had ended and the whites had left the beach.
Ann Bruder, I really appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ann Bruder, a senior architectural historian at the Maryland State Highway Administration, has researched establishments in Maryland that were listed in the Green Book. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break now, and then we'll speak to two people with insights about how the Green Book was used. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We talked earlier with Ann Bruder, senior architectural historian at the Maryland State Highway Administration. She's working to document and preserve the Maryland sites listed in the Negro Traveler's Green Book, a segregation-era guide published by and for African Americans that identified safe, welcoming places to dine, shop, and sleep. Joining us now is Dr. Helena Hicks, who has memories of using the Green Book. She's a civil rights activist, educator, and was also a participant in the 1955 sit-in at the then racially segregated Reed's Drugstore in downtown Baltimore. It's an honor, Dr. Hicks. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
And also with us is Tracy Wright, Upper School Dean of Students at the Park School. She incorporates Green Book content into a civil rights history field trip for her students. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Hicks, you've traveled quite a bit for your work with the federal government in the 50s and 60s. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I was reviewing child welfare programs, that the was the then Health and Welfare.
HEW, so, yeah.
HEW, Welfare Services Finance. And I went on my own. I had always a partner who I eventually caught up with at the site, and most often that person was white. So the review, they thought, I guess, wouldn't be slanted.
So this wasn't to ease your traveling challenges. This was so that they would hear from both.
They would give
an African American researcher and a white researcher asking these questions.
Yes. And I went to some interesting places all over the United States. And what I found was that the green books could get me there. The places that they had listed sometimes no longer existed. They changed ownership. It was a transitional time in the country by the time you got to the 60s. So nothing was the same. So there weren't a lot of help. They helped more with places to eat than it was to sleep, because invariably, because of my civil rights activity, I always had backup places where I could stay if I got there and it didn't meet my expectations, or I didn't, which was mostly if I was going to be safe, so that I had another place that I could stay. I think that staying in a place in any of the parts of the United States was very hard to judge during those transition years. Once civil rights set in, everything changed. Masks went up, so places that appeared safe were not always safe. Places went under different ownership. Places were just outright sold, didn't exist anymore. So the green books, while they helped get me going in the right direction, I could not always rely on them for comfort and safety.
Tracy Wright, how did you find out about the Green Book?
So I learned of the Green Book on a trip in 2012 to the International Civil Rights Museum in Greensboro.
This is a
trip we do every year with students from Park School, City College High School, and City Neighbors Charter School. This year in 2012, we added the museum in Greensboro to our itinerary. On that tour, we learned about the Green Book. That was the first time that I had encountered it or knew anything about it. And I was amazed just looking at the places that provided safe haven for African Americans. And since then, every year that we go to that museum, students learn about the Green Book. And as best we can, we ask students to just think about a time when they could not access any place that they wanted to, but that they had to learn where they could stop, where they could get a cup of coffee, where they could be treated as full human beings and citizens of the United States.
And how do students react to that thought experiment?
I think they're shocked by it. I think they're shocked to learn how limited people's experiences could be. But for many students, they are empowered to learn what it means to create your own community so that you know that you're treating people in a safe and respectful and hospitable way.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Tracy Wright, Dean of Students in the Upper School at the Park School, and with civil rights activist Dr. Helena Hicks. We're talking about the Green Book from the segregation era. So you feel like students learn something from it, but they're shocked by it. Why do you think this history isn't better known?
For the most part, it's by design. That we don't want students to know the full history. I believe that when you learn about the history, you know what to do to impact it moving forward. So much of this information is not taught in the classrooms, which is why we created this trip so that students have the opportunity to meet people like Dr. Hicks, to learn about the experiences, and to use their experience and courage to think about ways to impact society today. And so I think it's incumbent on students and on the schools to teach students this information.
But when you say by design, then who do you think wanted to want students not to know that history?
I think that the history of African Americans and First Nations people and Native Americans has not been something that's been taught. And I think it is a huge mar on American education not to teach the truth to young people. And maybe it's fear that if students, that if educators, people know that students know the depth of degradation and limitations put on people, I think people would be, young people would be more angry than they are. Mm-hmm. And so I think...
Are your students angry on these trips when they encounter the Green Book and why the Green Book was necessary?
They are angry. They are hurt. There is, I think, a huge sense of outrage at what has happened in the past, but also what's happening now. And the purpose of our trip is to learn about nonviolent tactics to think about how they can change today's inequities.
It was just a few years after the Civil Rights Acts were passed that the Green Book ceased publication. And some people would look at that and say, well, it was no longer needed. What are your thoughts about that, Dr. Hicks?
I think because the money was not there to widely circulate it, that it didn't, it wasn't that it wasn't needed. It wasn't able to keep going. I think that most African Americans, including me, were not aware of its significance and of how helpful it could be and how it was a way of gauging where society, where American society was in their acceptance of people who were not white. In the South, because the South was so heavily segregated, they were a bit more in tune to how limited they were in movement. In places like Baltimore, especially, where we had very little segregation to speak of. We had an interesting kind of segregation. You could go on in stores, buy things you couldn't try more. It's just a different kind of segregation. You could go in and try on hats, but you couldn't go next door and try on a dress. So it was so, it was so much of a puzzle. That it depended on what piece of the puzzle you had. And so if you got to a place and you wanted to stay overnight, if you were in the South, they would tell you, we don't service. Well, we've changed our name so many times. We don't serve colored people. We don't serve Negroes. Now we don't serve black people. We were all of those things. And so you knew right then and there to turn around and go on where... our experience, the further north you came, it was, we don't have any room. You know, you should have let us know ahead of time. Or these are the only rooms we have available, which were rooms you didn't want. It was a much different kind of segregation. It really was word of mouth that taught you where you could go and where you could not go. And you sort of did that when you traveled. You contacted somebody and asked them, which is what I did, even though there was a Green Book, because, as I said, things rapidly changed.
Tracy Wright, in retrospect, from your civil rights tour travels, have you become aware of any surprising impacts of the Green Book?
What I understand is the book created a network for black people to create their own community, their own self-sustained, thriving community where black people were able to be treated fairly and with respect. And so instead of saying we won't travel or we're fine sleeping in our cars, black businesses were created to sustain the black community.
I'm grateful to you both for talking to us about this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's civil rights activist Dr. Helena Hicks and Tracy Wright, Upper School Dean of Students at the Park School, talking about their experiences with the Green Book, a pre-civil rights travel guide published by and for African Americans that listed safe places throughout the country to dine, shop, and sleep. Earlier, we spoke with Ann Bruder, a senior architectural historian at the Maryland State Highway Administration, who researched establishments in Maryland that were listed in the Green Book. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.